This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. Carol Masser, along with Tim Stenovek, we mentioned some of the COVID headlines. We know U.S. regulators have given emergency approval for people ages 12 to 15 to receive a third dose of Pfizer's vaccine. I do feel like all of this stuff is going to be very helpful.
Do they get it, though?
I don't know.
That's the question.
Yeah, there is always that issue, right? We do know a record 10 million people were diagnosed in the 7 days through Sunday, almost twice the previous weekly high as Omicron spread across the globe. So we are dealing with those numbers. That's the tough part of it.
Another question. Do we still care about numbers? If everyone's going to get this, do we care about case count or do we care more about hospitalizations and deaths?
It's a great question. Let's put that to our next guest. Dr. William Hazeltine is back with us, Chairman and President of Access Health International. You know who they are. They're a nonprofit. They're on a mission to really improve access to high quality and affordable healthcare for people everywhere. Dr. Hazeltine, so well known in the biotech world. He's founded several biotech companies, including Human Genome Sciences, and he joins us once again on the phone from Connecticut. Dr. Hazeltine, so good to have you here with Tim and myself. How are you?
I'm very well, and I wish you both a happy new year.
Well, same to you. A happy and healthy one to all of yours. What's the number we need to focus on when it comes to COVID cases versus hospitalizations versus deaths and so on?
It would be a real disaster to give up counting cases of infection. The reason for that is that's how you allocate resources. You have to know where that infection is. Secondly, it is also going to be an indicator of what's going to happen in the future, what's going to happen with long COVID. Everybody talks about hospitalizations, but, you know, in any battle, you count the wounded, the hospital, and the dead. It's important to count the dead, of course. It's important to count hospitalizations. But those who are wounded, maybe seriously wounded for a long time, at least half of those who have mild cases may have 2 or 3 months of serious issues, and about 10% may have long-term, very serious mental issues, issues with their kidneys, needing transplants, diabetes, heart disease, a lot of really big problems. So it's really important. It would be a big disaster. You know, we count flu cases as well as flu hospitalizations and death. So I think we have to keep counting cases. It tells us what's happening where. It's also a very good guide for you personally to figure out what your risk is of getting infected. It's sort of like the weather. It's a weather report. Is it sunny? Is it raining? Is it a thunderstorm or a tornado? You have to know what the infection rate is in your area. It's a very, very big mistake to think we should give up case counting.
Okay, that's good to know. Hey, Dr. Hazeltine, help us understand how you're thinking about the Omicron variant. We're getting more and more data each and every day, and the data continue to tell us that perhaps this isn't doesn't make people as sick as previous variants, including the Delta variant. What do we need to know about the Omicron variant?
I think that, again, is false reassurance. First of all, we know highly, highly transmissible, and that you and I know that we have people who've never been infected before who are very carefully and triply vaccinated and even triply vaccinated and previously infected who are getting infected. And some of them are getting pretty sick. I have friends that have been sick for 10 days already with this. So it may be, on the statistical basis, putting fewer people in the hospital. And it looks like that's likely to be true, especially if you're vaccinated. I think we have very little data on what happens to that large fraction of people who aren't vaccinated. Second thing, before we're willing to write this off as mild and therefore not worry about it, what's happening to our kids? It's putting a lot of our kids and young people in the hospital, 3-4 times more than any other pandemic we've had of this, any other waves we had in the past. So I think those are really big questions. And finally, we don't know what this is going to do for long COVID. I saw one summary of this was a Trojan horse, and inside were little Omicrons saying long COVID. So we really have to take a good look at what the pathogenesis is going to be. I think the responsible attitude is to say it's serious, let's take it carefully, and do whatever we can to avoid it.
Yeah, it's something Tim and I know talk about. I know we talk about it at home. I have a daughter who's 18, and she's like, my fear, knock on Formica, that she hasn't gotten it. And she thinks about, I'm a young person. What happens if I'm one of the long haulers? I do wonder, too, Dr. Hazeltine, you know, we have had members of the medical community on saying, we're all going to get it. And in some ways, that may help it burn itself out. But is that true? Like, I do wonder, are we still possibly at risk of a variant that is very contagious and very virulent at the same time?
We are. And I think that those people who've always said, there's always been a tendency for people to say that this is the last one, we're going to get herd immunity. I think it was clear from the very beginning that there is no such thing as herd immunity for coronaviruses. Hmm. Coronaviruses come back as colds every year, despite the fact you've had it the year before, and they give you another cold. And this thing is going to keep coming back. It has been evolved to bypass our immune defenses. Now, we're fortunate that the vaccines seem to reduce hospitalization by about tenfold, which is fantastic. But how long that will hold, we don't know. We just have no idea yet, whether it's a year, 2 years, or 3 years. We're pretty sure it's not going to be forever. But this virus is never going to be such a thing, in my opinion, as herd immunity, whether it's induced by vaccine or by infection. We have to take this really seriously, gear up our massive research efforts, which we have. We have the capability to do it, find many ways to stop this, whether it's with drugs or better vaccines, or continual vaccines. We have to take this really seriously. And it's not going to go away. It's not going to go away for herd immunity, for sure.
Hey, Dr. Hazeltine, last question. When is this going to be in the rearview mirror for us?
Unpredicted. Hmm. I'm not willing to make that prediction. I don't see it appearing in the rearview mirror. You asked the question, can this combine both transmission and lethality? The answer is yes. It's what we're worried about. My immediate worry is it's going to recombine with Delta. A friend of mine calls it Omicron. So we might create a new hybrid. There are a lot of people with both infections in this country right now, and we know this virus is a master at recombining. So I think I don't see the rearview mirror appearing yet.
It's interesting you say that whole idea of what you said earlier, too, about the false sense of security. I heard people saying, well, it's only going to be Omicron. It's not so lethal. And then we were having a conversation at home, but it was like, well, what if I get it and I actually get it from the Delta variant, you know, and it's a lot more serious. Dr. Hazeltine, always good to get some time with you. Please stay safe and healthy. Chairman and President of Access Health International joining us once again on the phone from Connecticut. He's also author of CVPTSD, COVID-related post-traumatic stress disorder, what it is and what to do about it.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Workers, we know, continuing to work remotely, increasingly so with the rise in COVID cases. Meantime, their kids are spending more time in the office. For more on what's going on, Tim, it's a story you'll find online at Bloomberg Business Week.
Let's bring in Jeff Green, who wrote the story. He's managing diversity reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us on the phone from Michigan. Also joining us is Joel Weber, editor at Bloomberg Business Week. He is joining us on the remote access line from Brooklyn. Happy New Year to both of you guys. First, Joel, I want to start with just for people who don't have kids, maybe they don't understand or know what Bright Horizons is. So let's start with Bright Horizons, because that's a central part to the story.
Oh, man. So Bright Horizons has a network of facilities across the country that allow you to basically have a daycare option. And a lot of people and a lot of employers use that as sort of an emergency safety net.
Present company included, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's all part of your EAP program. And disclaimer, Bloomberg is included in that. They also have an in-home option that pre-COVID, like I personally would take advantage of when things went awry. And, you know, as we were working on a series of stories that we were calling the new rules of work, Jeff's reporting on the company sort of fascinated us, because here's a company that actually has a business model that could only become more helpful for employers as we deal with these, ongoing school dilemmas, ongoing childcare issues, and, you know, Omicron in some ways embodies that. So Jeff, tell us about what you discovered and what the future holds for the company.
Yeah, what really led me into this is the fact that, like, the core of their business is offering on-site daycare for people who go to the office. So my, you know, initial assumption was, well, this can't be good because, you know, nobody's going to the office. But, in you know, sort of just after, you know, 10, 20 minutes talking to the CEO and then also looking at what was happening, it became clear that, you know, there's this daycare crisis that we already knew about. Here's a company that offers not just on-site daycare, but subsidized, like 25 to 50% reduction for the employees, for the, you know, 120,000 kids whose parents are lucky enough to have this option. And so what could have been a disaster, they had to close like 850 of 1,000 centers right off the bat when the pandemic came. Now they're almost all back opened, and, you know, people are using it as a retention tool or a recruiting tool for new employees, saying, hey, you know, come here, we'll pay for your daycare, and you can, you know, have them right here at the office. And even if you're not coming to your office, your kids can be here. So it was completely not what I expected to hear. I thought I was going to hear this story of shifting completely to another line of business, but it turned out their core was actually positioned well too.
You know, Jeff, I feel like for so many years it's been taboo to like even talk about, you know, childcare at the office. It's really, and I don't know whether it's cause of COVID specifically, but things have changed dramatically.
Yeah, a lot of people didn't really care if their employees had children or not, except, you know, maybe in the HR department. But you start to see them on Zoom and you realize, you know, when your own EVPs of whatever are on Twitter talking about how rough it is to parent during the pandemic, suddenly people are like, wow, like a lot of people have children and some of those people are struggling.
CEOs have children.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and I mean that is sort of, it's almost a bittersweet tale because so many of us, I mean, I shouldn't say us because we technically qualify for at least the temporary version, but so many, very few people can actually get the full-on subsidized on-site daycare that this offers. So for those people who are lucky enough to work for those companies, this is a solution to a problem that for most people still doesn't really seem to have any kind of, you know, the Building Back Better is kind of stalled, which had some money toward it. It's just we don't really see an answer for most people for this problem.
Yeah, Jeff, talk a little bit more about this, because you do make that point in the story that this is something that is really for the luckiest of employees in the United States, a benefit that's really only available to, in the greater scheme of things, a handful of people. What is the conversation that's happening nationwide, and how has that changed in the Biden administration and with the stalling of Build Back Better? Does that become something in 2022 that's kind of on the back burner?
Yeah, I mean, unless the government or somebody is going to come forward and say, hey, everyone who has children, here's subsidized daycare for you. I mean, in some places, your daycare costs more than your rent. So yeah, if you want to be a member of the workforce, and, you know, I mean, you can't just keep your kids at home like we did during the pandemic. That's not a long-term tenable solution for anyone who's tried to, you know, have a meeting and have a toddler or even a teenager who has, you know, things they need to do. It works in an emergency, but it's not like the solution for forever.
So speaking of forever solutions, Jeff, like the other thing that a CEO of a childcare company like this would face is just this ongoing labor shortage. What did you learn on that front? Because already, you know, childcare is not childcare professionals are not getting paid, you know, what would even be deemed a living wage for the most part, right?
Yeah, that's one of the other advantages they have being this sort of, you know, on-site high-end partner is they can pay more. They also offer the ability to get a higher education degree in child care, or, you know, in child whatever. I mean, you can basically get a college degree by working here and take yourself even farther into this field to a higher level of pay. So it's that, but it's still, I mean, one of the reasons they don't expect a full return to their margins until maybe later this year or next year, whatever the latest estimate is the headwind of having to pay more. I mean, they're not immune to it. It's just they start from a better position and they're able to maybe attract people with some of the benefits that others just can't offer for the same reasons we've been talking about. It's really hard to, you know, $11, $12 an hour is kind of the tops for a lot of these daycare providers.
Okay, so the other thing that you can do when you're in this business is to not just do childcare, and growth for the company looks like what?
Yeah, so, I mean, you mentioned the emergency care, really high margins there. They added 150 at least new customers in that area. I think it was 150, more than 100. And everyone they add is bringing in higher margin business because that's basically, you know, any company, including ours, pays up front for a certain number of days, and then also will add days as more are needed. And then you have some of these other, they bought Sitter City, they bought a camp provider, which will be, you know, loom a lot larger as we come into, like, what, the third summer of a pandemic, and people are trying to figure out, you know, where our kids going to go, and, they, you know, now many of them are back at school, but they basically kind of hedge their bet. You can, in theory, use their services from everywhere from your toddler to your high school senior trying to find out how to get into college. They've been widening the aperture of, like, how they approach children. And in fact, some of their customers have been demanding it. They wanted, you know, they used some of their facilities that were closed as, like, middle school care kind of centers during the pandemic.
Well, I also love how they're kind of helping out what they call that sandwich generation, right? Those individuals, because they're looking into also, I guess, providing elder care. So it's interesting that they are looking to kind of help us on all different levels so that we can actually work, whether it's from home or elsewhere. It is another great story from you, Jeff. Thank you so much. Jeff Green, he's managing diversity reporter at Bloomberg News on the phone from Michigan. You can check it out. It is online at businessweek.com. Jill Weber, he's editor of Business Week magazine. And of course, you can find all those stories online on the terminal, and of course check out the news stands because you can pick up the magazine as well. What?
It's easy to work from home with a 3-year-old. No way. Not a chance.
It's not
impossible.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We've been talking about it already and watching. It's staying near its highs of the day. It's Tesla. Bam, yeah. It's up more than 13% today.
Tesla smashing quarterly deliveries with a record of 308,600 cars. I saw Danahol's article yesterday, last night about this. I sent it to my team at Quick Take Stock, and I said, watch Tesla stock tomorrow and see what happens after this. Let's bring her in now. Danahol is technology reporter for Bloomberg News. She joins us on the phone from San Francisco. Dana, you've been covering Tesla for years. This number, as you write, surpassing, you know, even the company's own expectations. Were you pretty blown away with it?
I mean, it was a very strong quarter. It really begs the question, like, why did the analysts get it so wrong? I mean, it's this expectations game where, you know, the analysts put out, so, you know, analysts have their own models, and then Tesla itself sends around its own consensus figures, which is sort of broader. But, I mean, they beat by, like, 45,000 units. Like, it's rare to have a beat that's quite this large. Our Bloomberg consensus figures were 263, and they delivered 308,600. So, I mean, that's like a pretty significant beat. And, you know, I think it just shows that despite the semiconductor shortage, despite COVID, despite logistics, that there is demand for electric vehicles. And, I would love more visibility from the company as to how many of these cars were sold in China. We don't have a lot of visibility into the regional breakdown. This is big for Tesla. I mean, the transition is here, and we're just sort of seeing that accelerate quarter after quarter.
All right, so already up 13% this year because it's the first day of trading. We've got a $1.2 trillion market cap, Dana. You mentioned you'd like more visibility in terms of the geographic breakdown. Why? What are you looking for specifically?
Well, Tesla just, you know, their report is just very bare bones. It's like, we sold this many cars this quarter and this year, and, like, we'd like to congratulate everyone on the Tesla team, but they don't say where the cars are going. And you can usually find it in the 10-Q, which will come out after earnings, where they break down what their largest markets are. It's traditionally been the U.S., then China, and then, like, Norway or the Netherlands. But I mean, I'm just curious, like, I mean, is the U.S. still on top? Has China overtaken the U.S.? I mean, we really don't know. And so you have to kind of piece together market data from a lot of disparate sources. And given, you know, that Tesla is the market leader, I just would love it if they would be more transparent about, you know, what is their top market? And, I think that's just information that everyone would know, because people get very hung up on, like, monthly sales in China. But then, because of the logistics of shipping cars, the monthly sales aren't always super accurate. So I don't know. I would just love more from the company. Maybe we could press on that during earnings.
Yeah, and I mean, Elon Musk might not be on the call, right? Because he's kind of...
Oh no! He will be on this call. He tweeted that he's gonna come on the call. You know, so he was. I mean, it's so funny. Like, Elon loves the limelight, so he made this big thing of saying, "I'm not going to be on the call unless I have something to say." He was not on the last earnings call for the first time in a decade. But then in November, he tweeted that he would be back on the call in January with a significant product update. So First call of the year, he will be on the call.
Dana, what do you think? Is it something about a Cybertruck, perhaps? That thing still hasn't made an appearance.
Yeah, I mean, Tesla has not. So I think that I would imagine. I mean, Tesla has all of these vehicles in the wings: the Cybertruck, the semi-truck, the next generation Roadster. They've talked about making a cheaper car in China. I mean, maybe they'll make a delivery van. Who knows? But the truck is clearly the next car in their product pipeline. And this is the year of the electric truck. I mean, you have the competitors like, Ford and Rivian all coming out with their trucks. I mean, they're already out with their trucks. Like, the Rivian truck is out. And so, I would imagine that the Cybertruck will be a significant part of that.
Is this a make or break? Maybe that's stupid to say. But, I mean, I feel like it's going to be a significant year for EVs overall, Dana. And, when I think about Mercedes, we've talked with them, and they've got an EV, and we're seeing that higher-end market certainly get more competition, increasingly so. How is that going to make things more difficult for Tesla potentially this year?
Well, I've sort of argued this for a long time, and I'll make the argument again. I think we need to kind of shift the way that we think about competition. The mm-hmm. competition is not EVs and EVs fighting each other. The competition is really EVs versus ICE vehicles. Mm. So as more and more people make the shift to EVs, the kind of share of the EV pie is going to continue to grow. And that's actually good for Tesla. Like, the more that EVs become normalized, the better it is for sort of everyone. Tesla might, quote-unquote, lose market share to other EV makers, but they will continue to grow sales year over year, if that makes sense. I mean, like, they grew sales just a phenomenal amount this year. And coming into the new year with two new factories coming online, they'll be able to continue to do so.
So, Dana, to that end, I've been asking the question to other people today, is there a chance that Tesla sometime soon becomes the company that produces more vehicles than any other automaker in the world?
Well, they have a long way to go to get to that. I mean, like, compared to like Toyota and Volkswagen, but do they make the most EVs in the world? Absolutely.
Yeah, it's fascinating. There was a column, I think, too, on the Bloomberg that just says people thinking about their cars, you have to be thinking about, if you buy a new car today, what's the resale market in 5 or 6 years when you typically often sell off a car?
How's the battery doing?
Well, but not even that. Like, are you going to want to buy an ICE, right, an internal combustion engine, when maybe in 5 or 6 years nobody's going to want them? And so that just kind of pumps up the demand for EVs. But there is that battery story, too. Dana Hull, she's the best. She's Bloomberg technology reporter. We love talking all things Tesla and Elon Musk with her.
I'm driving in my car.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no. This is not a toy.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, folks, just about 10 minutes left in our trading day. We've got stocks really hovering near their highs of the session. I thought I had seen that we could see maybe records, is it, in the S&P 500 today, but we'll keep an eye on that for you.
Yeah,
is that possible, right?
Yeah, and by the way, this is still a Santa Claus rally. We got one more day.
He's gone back to the North
Pole. The technical definition of a Santa Claus rally includes the first two trading days of the new year.
All right, market captain. All right, let's get to it with Steve Brown. He's Senior Portfolio Manager at American Century Investments. They've got $250 billion in assets under management. He's co-manager on the company's real estate fund and the global real estate fund. That latter fund, by the way, beating most of its peers over the past 5 years, returning on average annually nearly 14%. He's on the phone in New York City. Hey, Steve, how are you? Happy New Year.
I'm great. Happy New Year to you, too.
All right. So some optimism in the markets despite yields moving up. It's been an interesting first day, but a first day does not necessarily make a market year. What are your expectations as you look at 2022?
Sure. We had a very strong year in 2021. And as we step into 22, we see a couple of things that are still in place. We see
REITs were really strong last year, right? I mean, if you look at one measure, I think it was up. I look at the Dow Jones Equity REIT Total Return Index up 41% last year. That's a big bump.
Yes. They were one of the worst performing asset classes in 2020, so they did have a big bounce back.
Fair.
But in general, a couple of the drivers for strong performance are the inflationary trends, a lot of liquidity, and demand being stronger than supply in many property types. And as we enter 22, a lot of those factors are still true today. Demand is greater than supply for many property sectors and regions of the world. And, you know, as we sit here today, inflation is still running, you know, 5, 6, 7%. The Fed is taking actions to address it. But I think in the first half of this year, we're going to continue to see inflation relatively strong. And there are a number of property sectors that have been able to raise rents, you know, at the same level as inflation. So they have showed some very good earnings growth, both in 2021, and we expect to be that case in 2022 also.
Okay, so where does the Fed come into this, and where does monetary policy come into this? Because I know from your notes that our producers gave us that you still expect easy money policies to continue throughout the world, even though we see tightening happening.
Sure. My point is that last year, 2021, we had extremely easy money policies. And this year, 2022, we expect to have easy money policies. So
from extremely easy to easy.
Still easy.
Yeah. So there's still a lot of liquidity out there. Rates are still very low. I mean, the Fed wants, as I said, or the bond market has said, that the Fed may raise the Fed funds rate, you know, three times this year, you know, maybe up to 75 basis points or something like that. And the 10-year, you know, it's around, like you said at the top of the hour, it's about 1.6% right now. You know, if that drifts higher to 2% or so, I mean, that's still a very accommodative environment for economic activity as well as real estate activity.
You have noted, as Tim mentioned, some of the research you guys shared with us and some of the notes, that property owners continue to benefit from demand being greater than supply in many markets. You mentioned it earlier. REITs, there's all kinds of REITs, right? There's commercial, broadly speaking, that, but you could break it down into hospitality. You can break it down into office properties. You can break it down into retail. You know, where are we seeing demand in particular being greater than supply in many markets or even geographical variations?
We see, generally speaking, you know, demand being greater than supply in rental housing, industrial, and self-storage, to name a couple, three. And let me go back to the first one, which would be rental housing. This could be off the apartment, it could be single-family rental properties, or it could be manufactured housing. They're all benefiting, these property owners, these real estate companies, from demand being greater than supply and the ability to raise rents at a higher rate than inflation. They're also being benefited by high home prices. I mean, home prices were probably up 20% or so in 2021. We don't expect that type of appreciation in 22, but there is still a very good demand for rental housing, and it remains in most parts of the world a shortage of affordable housing.
I know a lot of people who are selling their homes because they know that they're either going to move in the near term or something and taking advantage of a market that is just
and
off
they're selling
charts.
And renting?
Yep, yep.
There are those serious tax implications to doing that, right? If you take the gains and you don't actually buy new property.
That's true. That's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, but what we're seeing in general is that it's still relatively cheaper to rent than to buy because of the hurdle of putting down 10 or 20 percent as a deposit. So it really has opened the runway up for continued, you know, strength in the rental apartment market, whether it's in New York or the Sun Belt or other parts of the country.
Hey, Steve, let's talk a little bit about retail. And, you know, Simon Property Group is among your top holdings here. And I'm wondering how you're looking at retail and a recovery in retail.
Sure. Retail REITs, whether it was Simon or some shopping center REITs, performed very well in 2021. They bounced back from a disastrous 2020 as the economy generally reopened both in Europe, Asia, and in North America. So the stocks had a good bounce. As we sit today, we're still constructive on them for a couple of reasons. One is there's been a lot of leasing activity in 2021, and that should flow into 2022 into higher occupancy levels. Secondly, there have been very few store closings or bankruptcies on the part of retailers. So I think as we enter the peak store closing season, which is typically the first quarter of the year, store closing is going to be very low. And then thirdly, generally speaking, consumers are in good shape from a balance sheet perspective. So they have, you know, plenty of spending power. And so that combination of events, you know, rising occupancies, lower store closings, and a healthy consumer, you know, bode well for both consumer spending, but also for rent growth and NOI growth on the part of a Simon Property Group or some strip center names, like a Kimco or a Kite Realty, which own grocery anchored shopping centers.
What's your favorite space when it comes to REITs or within the commercial real estate market or even residential? Just quickly.
Sure. We still like industrial for a number of reasons. Demand is clearly greater than supply there, and the demand drivers of the growth in e-commerce, generally speaking. And it's not just Amazon or Shopify. It's also the traditional players like Walmart and Target, really emphasizing delivering the goods to the consumer in a shorter time. And the backup in the ports has put more pressure or more emphasis on getting the goods into the warehouses so these retailers can control the destiny a little better.
All right. Listen, Steve, thanks so much for joining us. Steve Brown, Senior Portfolio Manager at American Century Investments.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.